Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. While Israel's occupation forces are perpetrating a genocide in Gaza, the Zionist propaganda machine has gone into overdrive. Leading politicians are behaving like Tel Aviv's lapdogs, while corporate media hacks have been enthusiastically reciting Zionist talking points ad nauseam. But their efforts are falling on deaf ears as far as the general public is concerned. Latifa Abu Chakra has been examining Zionist efforts to influence public discourse by radicalising young Jews and the rent-a-crowd tactics they've been deploying on college campuses and social media.
Genocide is a difficult crime to cover up and a difficult crime to justify, which is why Zionists expend considerable resources training recruits to be impervious to human feeling, logic or evidence. Here is Harvard professor Ruth Weiss extolling the virtues of radicalization of young Jews from the point of view of the Zionist state.
Our job is not to make you look good, American Jews. What do you have to worry about? Your job is to make us look good. And here's how you do it. Every one of us has to serve 3 years in the army, 2 years in the army, some of us 5 years, and then for the rest of our lives. You have got to serve 2 or 3 years in the army of words. You've got to learn to fight the political battle, which is even more important at this point than the military battle.
There are many ways in which the army of words is supported by the regime. Israel Under Fire provides guidance, advising that do share images of the hostages, do share photos of our soldiers in humane moments. Do not explain Israel's policy. The issue here is not the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as a whole. It is very difficult for us to win there. Do not respond to anti-Israelis who seek to draw the discourse into a discussion about the Israel-Palestinian conflict as a whole. Instead, focus on the hostages, the elderly and children, the pain and suffering endured here. The killing fields for the army of words is the overall context of the conflict as settler colonialism, ethnic cleansing and genocide. And so they try and recruit from the grassroots. Back in 2009, at the Global Forum for Combating Anti-Semitism, they proposed the fight needs to be horizontal, not hierarchical. What we used to call grassroots, empowering college students to get involved using their skills, their media, their networks to push back. The fight should be hysterical. In 2002, a Hasbara handbook advised students that when leveling the charge of anti-Semitism is difficult, it is often worth expressing personal upset, saying that one was hurt as a Jew by the controversial act. Hysteria is backed up with large quantities of cash. The Israel on Campus Coalition was busted for offering $250 to students to turn out for the 14th of November pro-genocide rally in Washington, D.C. Social media influencers were also offered up to $5,000 to support Israel.
This was an email I received offering me $5,000 to go live and show my support for Israel.
But no amount of money can change the reality of the ongoing genocide in Gaza. And no army of words can erase the struggle of the Palestinians for liberation and decolonization.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University. And he's now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our guest today is Lee Camp, who joins us via Skype from New York. Lee is an American comedian, as well as a writer, podcaster, journalist and news commentator. He's the most censored comedian in America and was the host and head writer of the popular show Redacted Tonight on RT America for 8 years before it was closed down by the US government following Russia's special military operation in Ukraine. He now hosts the Dangerous Ideas show on Rumble. Lee's Jewish and went on a so-called birthright trip to Israel when he was 26 years old and saw at first hand exactly how it manipulates young people. Welcome to the show. David, I mean, this term genocide now is pretty ubiquitous, isn't it, to describe what's happening in Gaza. I mean, what difference do you think the onslaught on Gaza has made to the conversation about the occupation of Palestine?
Well, the mask has slipped. On the one hand, people see every day, children, babies, being dragged from the rubble, dead and dying or having limbs amputated. On the other hand, Israeli leaders and Zionist leaders have made a huge list of genocidal statements. The human animals, the unhuman animals, we must wipe them all out. There are no civilians in Gaza. All of these are patently genocidal statements. And people in the world see that. People didn't really realise, I think, before that, how genocidal Zionism is. Of course, it's always been that way. Back to the beginning, from 1948, the ideology has always been, has to be genocidal in order to force out the native population, which is the Palestinians. But people, I think, didn't realise the full magnitude of the genocidal nature of Zionism. But they do now, and that genie cannot be put back in its box.
No, indeed. Well, Lee, I mean, what do you make of Ruth Wies asserting that American Jews have a duty to directly support Israel and Zionism?
Yeah, it's really an admission. It's an admission that the truth, the reality on the ground, is not favorable to Israel. It's horrific. It's an oppressive apartheid, has been for years and years. And even before October 7th, you had people being shot by the IDF on a regular basis, targeting of journalists, hospitals, medics. It's just been terrible in so many ways. We talk a lot about hostages. Israel had 5,000 hostages before October 7th. They've now stolen, kidnapped another 5,000. So there are over 10,000 Palestinians imprisoned, actual in jails, not just the open air prison of Gaza. And so she's saying, your job is to lie, to act like this is okay. Your job is to lie, to defend genocide right now. And to me, it really is a massive admission. And the other thing is she's doing what I hate when people do, which is conflating being Jewish with being Zionist. These are not the same thing. Being Zionist means you support the apartheid of Israel. Being Jewish, there are many anti-Zionist Jews like myself. And on top of that, there are more Christian Zionists in America than there are Jews in the world. So it's nonsense.
Yes, indeed, indeed, indeed. And I think your point about hostages is well made, Lee. I mean, many of the people that have been snatched off the street are in what's called administrative detention. People just kind of locked away in Israeli dungeons with no due process, no even charge being brought before them. I mean, that clearly, it seems to me, is very much a hostage situation. But, David, you know, Latifa described in a report, or what she described in a report, is a kind of process of radicalisation, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, what we see here is the attempt to radicalise Jews outside occupied Palestine, in the US, in the UK, wherever there's an organised Zionist movement, to radicalise them so that they will support genocide, either through the army of words, fantastic phrase she uses there, in the US or the UK or elsewhere, or in the actual army of the occupation inside occupied Palestine. Of course, we know that there are many British Jews, American Jews, others who've come from those countries into occupied Palestine to serve in the occupation forces, and many of them are currently there engaged in the actual genocide. So that's a whole process which people, I think, didn't really recognise. We've talked before on the show about radicalisation, and people look at this as a little askance, and they say, well, it's not really. But now, of course, we see there are people from the streets of Britain currently killing Palestinians in Gaza, and that, if anything, is radicalisation.
No, indeed. Well, Lee, I mean, the Zionist lobby seems to spend a lot of money on creating guidance on fighting the propaganda war. I mean, what do you think that tells us?
Yeah, it tells us that people don't naturally endorse genocide. You have to pay them. You have to pressure them.
David, I mean, how do you interpret this apparent strategy of using fake grassroots groups and schooling them to feign hurt and to act hysterically?
Well, this is just as Lee is saying. This is an admission of weakness. They can't have millions of people coming out in the streets spontaneously supporting the genocide in Palestine, because, of course, those people are all on the other side of the argument. They have to instead pay them $250 a piece to appear at this demonstration in Washington, D.C. Who knows what the full budget was for that? 4,000 people would cost you $1 million. But, of course, the other question is not just the paying of people on social media or in demonstrations, but also the schooling of them in what to say, and to say, even if you can't show this anti-Semitism in a particular question that you're engaged in. You have to say you're hurt as a Jew to imply there's some form of anti-Semitic or anti-Jewish speech going on. So it's just exactly as we've seen with this confected nonsense about the slogan, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, as if the hurt or worry that people feel about that, which of course is largely fabricated, as if that could be matched against the 4,800 dead children in Gaza in the last month.
Mm. I mean, these cashing centres for demonstrations and social media influencers seems to indicate a degree of desperation, doesn't it, by the Zionist regime. I mean, do you think they'll be embarrassed about being exposed about this information?
I think they're singularly unembarrassable. And I think what's interesting about this is that you see them, the mask slipping, the genocidal statements, at the same time as them schooling and recruiting people for their demonstrations, etc. But what we haven't, I think, properly understood is that the genocidal statements don't just mean they are telling the truth about their ambitions for Gaza. They also indicate they're telling the truth something about their ambitions beyond Gaza. They want to, as some of them have been saying, they want to have Lebanon and Syria and Jordan as part of a greater Israel. Parts of Egypt even they would want back as well. And that is what's going on here. So the mask has slipped as far as we're concerned. We see the genocide. But what they've got in their mind is eliminating the Palestinians and moving beyond Palestine to take part of Lebanon and Syria and Jordan, etc. And that's the real aim of Zionism, and we ought to understand that.
No, indeed. Well, look, we'll come back to the discussion shortly after this report about the British Zionist movement's support for Israel's war crimes.
And the fact that you came here to do that...
It is not only the British government that's directly supporting the killing in Gaza, but they're also significant members of a newly visible cohort of what we might call British Zionists for Genocide. They're everywhere in the organized Jewish community, which is overwhelmingly Zionist. British Zionist organizations have been falling over themselves to pledge support for Israel after the start of the genocide on the 7th of October. The JC published a list of groups for readers to donate money to help Israel. The main Zionist groups have all rallied to support the Zionist entity in its full genocidal splendor. For example, the Zionist Federation, the United Jewish Israel Appeal, the Jewish National Fund, each of which are core elements of the Zionist movement.
The way I cope with it is by making cakes and goods for soldiers.
Even many synagogues are supporters of Zionist extremism. Here is the United Synagogue promoting a youth settler who, while in the UK, is helping to build support for the occupation forces, which are directly engaged in genocide.
I'm looking forward to coming back to you guys and tell you, oh, we've managed, we won.
The United Synagogue is the largest of five main synagogue movements in the UK, catering largely to Ashkenazi Jews, often described as modern Orthodox. It proudly claims to be Zionist on its website. Meanwhile, the Jewish chaplain at Leeds University in the north of England has been circulating videos of himself in occupation forces uniform, claiming that
no one could deny that Israel is dealing with this war with the utmost morality and good ethics. What Israel is trying to do is destroy the evil, which is the most moral thing possible.
All such chaplains are chosen by the University Jewish Chaplaincy, an organization which has charitable status. How many more chaplains are attempting to radicalize young Jewish students by promoting genocide? The University Jewish Chaplaincy is a member of the Jewish Leadership Council and the Board of Deputies, both avowed pro-Israel groups. They also get support from other extremist supporters of the genocide in Gaza, such as the convicted fraudster and founder of the CST, Gerald Ronson, via the Gerald and Gail Ronson Family Foundation. Property developer David Dangor of Monopro, which made £4 million in profits last year via the Elikarch Foundation, his charitable venture. It also donates to the Islamophobic Henry Jackson Society and various interfaith groups dedicated to Zionist penetration of the Muslim community. The Wolfston family, who own the retailer Next via the Charles Wolfston Charitable Trust, It has a history of donating to Islamophobic think tanks and the Jerusalem Foundation, which is directly involved in ethnic cleansing in Palestine. Of course, the radicalization of Jewish youth in the UK to recruit them to join the genocidal Israel occupation forces as foreign fighters is a core element of British Zionist strategy. The so-called Lone Soldier program for 16-year-olds and above is promoted to young Jews on campus and even in schools. One participant was the daughter of the revisionist Zionist extremist David Collier, who is a core part of the Zionist regime's troll network in the UK. He has recently traveled to occupied Palestine to continue legitimizing genocide on behalf of the regime. Zionism is not just a problem for the Palestinians. It's a problem for every country with an organized Zionist movement.
David, have you been surprised by the extent of support for the Gaza genocide amongst British Zionists?
I've not been surprised, no, because, of course, they sort of have to do it. But, of course, it means that they have to abandon the previous liberal niceties which come along with their policies, which they try and suggest that Zionism is not necessarily a racist thing. It can be about the yearning for a Jewish homeland. And that it's difficult to push that kind of line when babies are being dragged dead from the rubble in Gaza. So it's not surprising, no, but you have seen a real outpouring of support for this genocide in the pages, for example, of the JC, where all the main...
Jewish Chronicle,
The Jewish Chronicle, all the main lobby groups have taken out large adverts, many of them full-page adverts, the Jewish National Fund, the UGIA, even We Believe in Israel, which, of course, is headed by Luke Akehurst, the former arms industry lobbyist and Labour Party figure. So we've seen a huge outpouring of support from the Zionists for this, and it really compromises them, because they can't any longer pretend that Zionism has a nice face, because they've all abandoned all of that and gone straight into saying we stand with Israel in the context of this ongoing genocide. It really fundamentally undermines the pretensions of Zionism to make any kind of argument in a liberal democracy.
No, indeed. I mean, of course, it's not just the British Zionists, is it? I mean, we're seeing across the pond over in the United States, the US Zionists kind of replicating the scenario that we've seen in Britain, haven't we?
Of course, it's the same in the US, and it's the same, as the film says there, really, in every country where there is an organised Zionist movement. And the World Zionist Organization, for example, has members, Zionist federations, in 35 different countries throughout Latin America, India, Australia, throughout Europe as well. 35 countries where there's an organised Zionist movement. Of course, the main organised Zionist movements in the world outside of the occupied Palestine are in the US, the biggest one, followed by the UK, France and Germany. So it's important that we look at those areas, that all of those countries, the Zionist movements are doing the same kinds of thing. They're doing it because, of course, the talking points come from Tel Aviv. But their major effort is those places where they've got the largest concentrated organised Zionist movement, which is the US and the UK. Also the places which, of course, are key to supporting the genocide as it's happening in Palestine just now through the governments.
No, indeed. I get a sense, I don't know about you, that people are sort of seeing through this kind of Zionist facade, certainly how they weaponise anti-Semitism and so on. And I think anecdotally, what my sort of take on what's happening is that there's been a massive upsurge in support for the Palestinian people and a lot more cynicism, actually, about the sort of Zionist tricks. Is that your sense of what's going on?
Absolutely. I mean, think back in this country, in the UK, to the period of communism, where the ability to say straightly, in a factual sort of way, look, this is a Zionist trick. You could say that, but the number of people who would believe that and who would go along with that, who would nod, yeah, I can see that, was way less than it is now. Now everybody sees it. They see the genocide. That's why millions of people are on the streets, 1.2 million, it said last week in London, and across the whole of the world, 300 cities in the same day are demonstrating against the genocide. And the word genocide, as I've said, the word genocide trips off people's tongues. Everyone can see that this fits the definition of genocide, and that's what it is. Mm. And so, yes, they have fundamentally compromised their ability to win the argument, and that's because, you know, in the end, what they're doing is genocide, and they can't cover that up. It's visible for everyone to see.
No, indeed, indeed. I'm just going back to the package we just watched there. I mean, this university Jewish chaplaincy that recruits settlers and Zionist military reservists as chaplain. I mean, a chaplain. I was shocked. Does it shock you?
Well, it doesn't shock me, because let me tell you why. And the reason is that when I was at the University of Bristol, remember they sacked me in October 21.
Yeah.
When I was there, the chaplain, the husband and wife team, who was the Jewish chaplain, were advertised on the university website as having come from Israel.
Right.
And I was a little curious about this, and I worked out where they came from. They came from an illegal settlement in the West Bank.
Right,
and so yeah. I never said anything about it at the time, because, of course, I was in the middle of an investigation.
Of course.
So there we are. There's an example of people from an illegal settlement ministering to young Jewish, allegedly vulnerable Jewish students. And, you know, the kind of propaganda that they would be laying down for them can only be imagined. We already have seen in this example from Leeds, this guy from the occupation forces in uniform talking about it being the most moral way to kill children and babies. I mean, he doesn't put it in those terms, but that's what he's talking about. And this is stuff he was circulating to ordinary Jewish students at Leeds University. And, of course, his work and that of his wife were used across the universities in Yorkshire, four or five different universities around about Leeds, also subject to this kind of propaganda. Now, we haven't had any word from the University Jewish Chaplaincy about the extent to which this is a policy, that they make sure that they have people from the occupation forces or settlers who are Jewish chaplains or people from occupied Palestine becoming chaplains. But it looks like it's not something which they forbid or in any way look askance upon. And of course you can tell from the people who support it that wouldn't be what they would think. So the convicted fraudster Gerald Ronson, Charles Wilson Charitable Trust, the family who own Next, big huge supporters of Islamophobia, and indeed of the Jerusalem Foundation, for example, which is engaged in land theft and house demolitions in East Jerusalem. So these are all organisations which all support the genocide. I mean, Gerald Ronson, of course, comes from a pedigree of revisionist Zionism, which is absolutely of a piece with the Likudniks in charge of the current Zionist government.
Yeah. Well, we've got Lee back now. I mean, Lee, I mean, I just wondered whether you were surprised to hear that chaplain telling students that Israel's actions in Gaza are the most moral thing possible. I mean, David was just touching on it in his response. I don't know if you heard what David said, but what's your thoughts, Lee, about that?
It's unbelievable. It's gruesome. It reminds me of the 100 doctors that in Israel that signed a open letter saying that they wanted the Gaza hospitals bombed. And I guess, you know, in any society, you're going to have some sociopaths and some psychopaths. And it seems like they've rounded them all up to try and endorse these actions of just killing children indiscriminately. And it's repulsive.
Yeah. I mean, Lee, as well, I mean, what's your assessment of how U.S. popular opinion is shaping up on Gaza?
I'm actually really impressed that a lot of people are waking up, just thousands. I mean, we've seen some of the largest Free Palestine marches that the U.S. has ever seen, hundreds of thousands in Washington, D.C. Also, a recent Gallup poll showed that Democrats across the United States, for the first time ever, side more with Palestine than with Israel. This has never happened. And so, yeah, there's still a long way to go, but it shows that people are waking up, and Israel's losing this propaganda war, no matter how much effort and money, how many people they pay to show up at rallies. They're losing it. And they've awoken a sleeping giant by committing this genocide.
No, indeed. I mean, and you know, we're getting, certainly in the United Kingdom, unprecedented numbers of people on the streets, and from what you're saying, Lee, it looks like a very similar situation over there. We're seeing this really right across the world, across Europe and everywhere, people absolutely horrified and outraged at what they are seeing. But unfortunately, I'm afraid that we are out of time again, so we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank our guest, Lee Camp, and of course our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Palestine Declassified will be back next week with more forensic investigations and analysis. Until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Israeli military have ordered doctors, patients, and displaced people at Gaza's Al-Shifa hospital to evacuate the medical compound, forcing some people to leave at gunpoint. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Iran's Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. The Israeli military have ordered doctors, patients, and displaced people at Gaza's Al-Shifa hospital to evacuate the medical compound, forcing some people to leave at gunpoint. The forced evacuation order has caused panic and mayhem. The World Health Organization has issued its own assessment of the situation in the Gaza Strip's Al-Shifa hospital, describing it as a death zone and the situation as desperate. The United Nations Health Organization released its report early on Sunday, 19th of November, just a day after a short and very high-risk mission into the hospital on Saturday, 18th of November. The Israeli regime has turned Gaza's hospitals into a specific target of its ongoing war of genocide, alleging that those facilities house Palestinian resistance fighters and their equipment. On Saturday, Mai Al-Kaila, the Palestinian health minister in the occupied West Bank, strongly condemned Israel for committing genocide against the healthcare system in the Gaza Strip. The Al-Shifa Hospital, Gaza's biggest hospital, has taken the brunt of the Israeli assaults on the territory's healthcare system, with the Zionist regime claiming that it houses a command center belonging to the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas. The situation has forced scores of sick and injured, some of them amputees, to flee the hospital towards the seafront without ambulances, along with displaced people, doctors and nurses, according to the World Health Organization. The WHO added that only 291 patients, including 32 babies in extremely critical condition and 25 healthcare workers, have remained inside the Al-Shifa complex. Signs of shelling and gunfire were evident. The World Health Organization team saw a mass grave at the entrance of the hospital and were told more than 80 people were buried there. The World Health Organization said in a statement, "A lack of clean water, fuel, medicines, food and other essential aid has caused the hospital to basically stop functioning as a medical facility." Corridors and the hospital grounds were filled with medical and solid waste, increasing the risk of infection, according to the World Health Organization. Also on Sunday, World Health Organization's chief, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, wrote on X social media platform that the world body was working with partners to develop an urgent evacuation plan and asked for full facilitation of this plan. "We continue to call for protection of health and of civilians," he said, lamenting that the current situation is unbearable and unjustifiable. Meanwhile, Iran says it does not want further spread of Israel's genocidal war in Gaza, but the approach taken by the United States and the Israeli regime in the region makes the expansion of war quite possible. The Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remark in an interview with the Financial Times. Iran's top diplomat noted that during the early weeks and days of the war, American officials sent messages to Iran through certain diplomatic channels claiming that Washington was not after expansion of the scope of the war. Over the past 40 days, messages have been exchanged between Iran and the United States via the U.S. interest section at the Swiss embassy in Tehran, Hossein Amir Abdullahian emphasized. Amir Abdullahian added, "In response to the United States, we said that Iran does not want the war to spread any further. But due to the approach of the United States and the Israeli regime in the region, if the Israeli war crimes continue, then it is possible that the conflict would spread further." Amir Abdullahian added, "The United States has sent similar messages to Lebanon's Hezbollah movement, as well asking the movement to show self-restraint." The Iranian foreign minister said despite those messages, the United States has offered its full support to Israel and supplied the regime with all kinds of military equipment and weapons. He emphasized that Washington's unbridled support for the Tel Aviv regime proves that the United States is not committed to its claim of being against the further spread of the Gaza war. Washington, which has been trying to justify the Tel Aviv regime's ferocious attacks on Gaza as a means of self-defense, has been also casting its veto against the United Nations Security Council resolutions that call on the Israeli regime to cease its aggression. The Al Jazeera television network has also covered the same story. The Israeli military ordered doctors, patients and displaced people at Gaza's Al-Shifa hospital to evacuate the medical compound, forcing some to leave at gunpoint, according to Palestinian officials who talked to Al Jazeera. Doctors said the facility, which has been under siege by Israeli troops for several days, was now largely deserted hours after soldiers ordered people to leave the hospital on Saturday, 18th of November. But in a post on X, formerly known as Twitter, the Israeli army denied giving any order, saying the Israeli military responded to the request of the director of Al-Shifa Hospital to allow Gazan citizens who were sheltering in the hospital and those who wished to evacuate from the hospital towards the humanitarian crossing in the Gaza Strip via a secure access. However, Mohammad Zarud, Director General of Hospitals in Gaza, told Al Jazeera, "I categorically deny these false allegations from the Israeli army. I'm telling you, we were forced to leave the Al-Shifa hospital at gunpoint." He said the Israeli army called the hospital management at 8 a.m. local time and told them to evacuate the medical facility, the largest hospital in Gaza, within an hour. They were directed to exit along a route where charred bodies were strewn across the street, he added. Ismail Al-Thawabta, Director General of the Government Media Office in Gaza, said the Israeli army forced out more than 500 wounded people and patients at gunpoint. The Al-Shifa Hospital has turned into a detention camp, an interrogation center, a military barracks and mass grave altogether, he said. More than 7,000 people, including patients in critical condition and newborn babies fighting for their lives, were sheltered inside the Al-Shifa Hospital. A doctor in the hospital told Al Jazeera that around 9 a.m. local time, they received the order from the Israelis to leave the hospital in 1 hour, but that it was impossible to evacuate everyone as they did not have ambulances or transportation to transfer patients. "The situation caused a great state of panic and fear in the hospital," Al Jazeera's Yumna El-Sayed said, reporting from Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. "Many people left the Al-Shifa hospital on foot, but patients who cannot move, amputees and those with critical condition, were forced to remain behind with a handful of medical staff," Mohammed Abu Salmiya, the director of the Al-Shifa hospital, told Al Jazeera. Al-Salmiya added, "The situation is really dire." Those in Al-Shifa had included at least 300 patients, many of them in critical condition, as well as thousands of displaced families. It also included at least 35 premature babies who already, for 8 days now, have been out of their incubators because of the lack of oxygen and lack of electricity. Al Jazeera's Yumna El-Sayed reported there were 39 babies who had been left without incubators. Four of them died later on Friday, 17th of November, and five of them are currently severely ill. The Palestinian Minister of Health, Mai Al-Kaila, said the international institutions should intervene and transfer the premature babies from Al-Shifa Hospital to hospitals in either the occupied West Bank or in Egypt.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند ذکر خداست، ذکر الله تطمئن می‌کند.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa Allah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
This is a part of a speech of Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, on the issue of Palestine. Quds belongs to the Muslims and must return to them. It's a phenomenon concerning the monotheists and faithful people of all age, past, present, and future. The International Quds Day is a day in which Islam is to be revived. The International Quds Day is a day in which the destinies of the oppressed nations must be determined. The International Quds Day is a universal day. It's a day for the oppressed to rise and stand up against the arrogant.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله dear audience welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio This is Zainab Musavi and what we do in this program is to talk about some certain speeches and sentences of the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh and then shed light on some points and lessons in these speeches in order to be used by us in our everyday life Well, on the subject of sincerity, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, soundness and excellence of deeds depends on intention, receptiveness of the heart and observation of limits. Well, this sentence of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi is on the significance of intention and its role in the acceptance of a conduct. The element that gives importance to a person's action is his intention, motive or objective. So, in the verse of the Holy Book of Quran, the phrase, in the way of Allah, that is, fi sabilillah, is often used, and it is, you know, it is used 70 times in the Holy Book of Quran. And thus, it is used as a warning for people to ensure that their actions and intentions be in the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and not for the sake of other than God or their own carnal desires.
يا ربنا صل على طه النبي وآله
صلى الله عليه
صل يا
Intention is the pillar of worship and the essence and foundation of action. The most sacred acts are spoiled because of the mixed intentions behind them, while the simplest acts gain in value on account of the purely good intentions behind them. Anyone who strives in the way of God will also be guided by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala towards his path. As the Holy Book of Quran says, As for those who strive in us, we shall surely guide them in our ways. So you see, intention is the indispensable prerequisite for the acceptance of a deed. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam quotes a statement of God subhanahu wa ta'ala, "I do not accept anyone except the one who is sincere to me." So you see that when sincerity is accompanied by an action, it will be so much worthy that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala accepts it. And that is what Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi trying to tell us. Okay, dear listeners, it seems that our time for this episode has come to its end. For ending, let's just recite the sentence of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi about the concept of sincerity once more. Well, in that regard, he said, "Soundness and excellence of deeds depend on intention, receptiveness of the heart, and observation of limits." Thank you very much for being with us in this episode. I wish that you have enjoyed it, and until another one, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The Limelight.
The judge overseeing Donald Trump's civil fraud trial has said the former president's motion for a mistrial is utterly without merit, denying his effort to be heard on the issue. We take a look at the US media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. The judge presiding over former President Donald Trump's New York fraud case rejected a motion on Friday, 17th of November, seeking to have a mistrial declared. Donald Trump's attorneys made the request on Thursday, 16th of November, claiming Judge Arthur Engoron and his law clerk had displayed bias and that he conferred with her so much it was as if they were co-judging the case. Judge Arthur Engoron explicitly denied that claim on Friday and called the motion without any merit. "My rulings are mine and mine alone. There is absolutely no co-judging at play," Judge Engoron wrote. The judge and his clerk, Alison Greenfield, have been the subject of fierce criticism by Trump and his lawyers, who claim they have overwhelmingly favored New York Attorney General Letitia James's side in the case. The trial, which began on 2nd of October and is expected to last well into December, stems from a September 2022 lawsuit in which New York Attorney General Letitia James's office alleges that Trump, two of his sons, and their company engaged in a decade of fraud tied to Trump's financial statements. Letitia James is seeking $250 million for the state and additional penalties that would restrict the defendant's ability to do business in New York. Judge Arthur Engoron found the defendants liable for fraud in a pre-trial ruling. The trial is proceeding on other allegations related to falsification of business records, conspiracy and insurance fraud, and the appropriate damages and penalties to be imposed. Judge Engoron ruled that Donald Trump and his campaign twice violated a limited gag order the judge put in place on 3rd of October, after Trump posted a derogatory statement on social media sites about Greenfield. He's been ordered to pay $15,000 in fines related to the gag order violations. In the motion for a mistrial, the Trump attorneys complained that Judge Engoron consulted too frequently with Alison Greenfield. Trump's attorneys announced plans to file it the day he testified in the case on 6th of November, capping off an intense day of examination in which Trump, who has frequently criticized Judge Engoron and his clerk, even lashed out at the judge from the witness stand, pointing at him and calling him a fraud. In the court filing, Trump's attorneys claimed that the court has abrogated its constitutional responsibility to ensure that each defendant, including President Trump, receives a fair trial free from even the appearance of impropriety and impartiality. Judge Engoron wrote that he has an absolute unfettered right to consult with my law clerks in any way, shape or form that I choose. The Attorney General had proposed a briefing schedule to address the mistrial motion, but Judge Engoron ruled that was unnecessary, calling the motion itself without any merit and writing, "Subsequent briefing would therefore be futile." Trump legal spokesperson Alina Haber said, "As expected, today the court refused to take responsibility for its failure to preside over this case in an impartial and unbiased manner. We, however, remain undeterred and will continue to fight for our client's right to a fair trial." CNN Cable News Network has also covered this story and tells us more. The judge overseeing Donald Trump's civil fraud trial said the former president's motion for a mistrial is utterly without merit, denying his effort to be heard on the issue. Judge Arthur Engoron responded in a written order to Trump's claim earlier this week that the judge and his principal law clerk are biased against him. In the court filing, Trump's team cited the judge's rulings, commentary, and his law clerk's political activities. Trump asked the judge to grant an order to show cause, which would allow Trump and the New York Attorney General's office to make legal briefings and be heard on the issue. The Attorney General's team didn't object to a briefing schedule, but said they didn't want it to interfere with a trial, which is expected to finish next month. On Friday, 17th of November, Judge Engoron said there was no point for a briefing as he stands by his rulings and defended his law clerk's political activities, including donations that she made whilst campaigning for office, saying they fell within the appropriate limits. "I cannot sign a proposed order to show cause that is utterly without merit, and upon which subsequent briefing would therefore be futile," the judge wrote. "I stand by each and every ruling that I made, and they speak for themselves." Judge Engoron added, "There is absolutely no co-judging at play here." The decision came the day after a New York appeals court judge temporarily lifted Engoron's gag order on Trump and his attorneys to prohibit them from making statements about his law clerk. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered this same story. A New York judge has denied former President Donald Trump's motion for a mistrial in his civil fraud case, rejecting the claim that the judge and his principal law clerk had tainted the trial with bias. Judge Arthur Engoron issued a scathing rebuke to Trump's mistrial motion on Friday afternoon, 17th of November, describing it as utterly without merit. He defended the political donations of his law clerk and his own extrajudicial posts online to a school alumni website that came under fire by the former president's defense team. "I stand by each and every ruling, and they speak for themselves," Judge Engoron wrote in the 6-page decision. The judge accused Trump's counsel of cherry-picking purported evidence of misconduct without showing the full picture. The mistrial motion cited a comment made by Judge Engoron during Trump's testimony that the judge was not here to hear what Donald Trump has to say, but excluded his next sentence, which contextualized that comment. "Such argument is disingenuous and made in bad faith, as defendants omitted what I said immediately after that sentence, which is, I'm here to hear him answer questions," Judge Engoron wrote. "Indeed, those are precisely the roles of the witness and the finder of fact." That the judge had shared links about the case on his school alumni website also drew the ire of Donald Trump's legal counsel, which Judge Engoron objected to by asserting that none of this has anything to do with, much less does it interfere with, my presiding fairly, impartially, and professionally over the instant dispute. His clerk, who has become an unwitting main character in the fraud trial, was also targeted in the mistrial motion, which suggested that she has been given unprecedented and inappropriate latitude to act as a co-judge in the case. The law clerk frequently confers with Judge Engoron via whispers and written notes, frequently before orders are issued. "There is absolutely no co-judging at play here," Judge Engoron wrote. Trump's counsel also accused the clerk of making partisan political contributions in excess of strict limits, including to groups that oppose Donald Trump and support New York Attorney General Letitia James. Judge Engoron took to his clerk's defense in his order, again accusing Donald Trump's lawyers of presenting arguments lacking context. He cited a judicial ethics opinion asserting that the contribution limits do not apply to an appointee's contributions to his or her own campaign. Nor would there be such a monetary restriction on the purchasing of tickets to political functions. The New York judge also took aim at Donald Trump's counsel for attempting to conflate his clerk's attendance at legally and ethically permitted political events with his own political standing. Judge Engoron said, "Such arguments are nonsensical, and in any event they are a red herring, as my principal law clerk does not make rulings or issue orders."
Economic Divide.
The Israeli war in Gaza continues to claim civilian lives. The carnage is so bad that the world is turning against Israel and its staunch support of the U.S., for that matter, for supporting the genocide. Many people are horrified at the images of dead children, especially at the hospitals. Some have decided they would boycott Israeli-made products. Boycotting Israel, the topic of this edition of Economic Divide. Coming up in this program, how will boycotting Israel take place? Well, there has been an Arab League boycott, but it has not been enforced. Why is that? There's also diplomatic and military boycott. Then, let's take a look at the region, West Asia, or as it's called, Middle East in some corners. There's a trade embargo that can be placed from the countries in the region. Iran, for that matter, has recommended an oil embargo. Also, the normalization reversals. Will that take place? Then, we take a look at social media, the role that it has played an Israeli war on Gaza. The word needs to be spread. That's what social media has done. Generation Z has taken a liking to that when it comes to TikTok and also Twitter, known as X. Also, multinationals sustaining Israel is what needs to be stopped.
As Israel's genocidal war against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip continues, calls are growing among Arab and Muslim nations to boycott the Tel Aviv regime. In 1954, the Cairo-based Arab League endorsed a resolution to boycott Israel following its creation in historical Palestine. But the Arab League does not enforce the boycott, and boycott regulations are not binding on member states. Arab leaders have gradually abandoned the boycott movement and signed treaties with the regime. However, ordinary Arab people are urging their leaders and the Arab League to boycott the regime economically and politically. The boycott campaign has been accompanied by calls for Arab countries to sever ties with Israel. Calls for the boycott made by young, tech-savvy individuals have spread. The boycott campaign includes browser extensions, dedicated websites, and smartphone apps that identify prescribed products. More traditional methods are also in use. Giant billboards in several Arab nations have posted images of blood-stained children in bandages.
Do not look away. Do not look away from Gaza, away from Palestine, because it makes you uncomfortable. How could any genocide happen? People looked the other way.
I feel like if there's anything we can take away from this tragic, tragic situation in the Middle East, is Gen Z has been talking a lot about it on TikTok, Instagram, whatever. And I have learned so much more on TikTok in the past 4 days than I have like watching a news outlet or whatever.
Time now to take a look at the post online that took place. Well, needless to say, it seems like the floodgates have been opened because there have been so many that I'm sure you're familiar with the amount of information out there that was posted and continues to be posted online. First up, we picked this one. Activists in Missouri block a Boeing factory which sends bombs for Israel's genocidal attack against the U.S. government enabling the Gaza genocide. It's a people's duty to take action to stop complicity. Next up, since day one, Zionists turned occupied Palestine into a base for terrorism. Israel is not a country. It's a terrorist camp against Palestinians and other Muslim nations. Fighting this despotic regime is fighting against oppression and terrorism, and this is everyone's responsibility. Next, a boycott flavor in this particular post. After just 3 weeks of boycott, Starbucks in Malaysia has reduced operation hours nationwide due to the devastating loss of customers. The next step would be individual outlet closures and, eventually, the complete disappearance of Starbucks from the country. Now, in Egypt, also a boycott move where a discount of £73, they have said this is crazy in that country. This has never happened before. In addition to the brands of Pepsi, Coca-Cola, and others, everyone stopped buying them completely. And whoever buys them, we treat them like an outcast. So you can see how the boycott movement there is actually pretty much, not only in Egypt, it's taking momentum around the world. Okay, let me introduce our guests for our program. We have first Oliver Boyd Barrett. He's an emeritus professor of Ohio and at Ohio and California University. And he's also the author of Conflict Narratives in Syria. Oliver Barrett, welcome to Economic Divide. It's good to have you with us. To begin with, many are not aware that there has been an Arab League boycott of Israel, but it's not enforced. It was adopted by them to boycott Israel and other relations between the Arab states and Israel, but the fact that they don't enforce it is where the problem is. Tell us why this was adopted, what it's all about, and why it's not being enforced, especially at this time.
I,
I believe that the Arab League has in the past